This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Guido Mazet is the co-founder and co-director of the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism in Montpelier and the chief herbalist at Urban Moonshine, which sells herbal extracts. Mazet says we're still discovering new herbal combinations and applications, but he's amazed at how sound old ways of thinking about how to use herbs are still. People have been using herbal remedies for pretty much as long as we've been people. And these days, there are a lot of ways you can get access to herbs. Mazet says herbs are part of a healthy lifestyle, but he's clear-eyed about what they're good for and where they fall short. Have cancer? You should probably see an oncologist. But if you have a cold, you may be able to, as he puts it, look to herbs to avoid using a sledgehammer for a mosquito. We're going to learn more about what herbs are good for and take any of your questions about how they can be added to your repertoire today on the show. Guido Mazet, welcome back to Vermont Edition. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Jane. It's great to be here.
All right. So we should say, you and I were just chatting before the show. Unfortunately, you can't cure the common cold, which pains me greatly given my current state. But what can you do for something like a cold that's sort of more of an herbal remedy than going to the drugstore and finding something in pill form?
Yeah, unfortunately, those winter viruses are tricky once you catch one and the symptoms start to develop. You've already had the virus for a long time and the immune system has been trying to work on it. So really what herbs can offer is comfort and support. And traditionally, herbalists have looked to warming remedies, things that help improve circulation and, you know, maybe help us sweat a little bit at night to kind of get over the cold a little more quickly. So one of my favorites is ginger, which makes a great tea. And we also like herbs that maybe sometimes taste a little sour, like some of the lemon you were using in your tea, and that might moisturize the throat and make a dry throat feel a little better. And honestly, for me, that's one of the greatest values for a plant like echinacea. Kind of numbs the throat and leaves a little tingling sensation if things are a little dry down there. So, you know, if you can use some herbs like ginger, cook with some plants like garlic, warm up the circulation and do some things to support your throat, you usually get over the cold a little more quickly and you feel a little better while that's going on.
So what's the idea here for you? How do you see herbal treatment fitting in with Western medicine?
Well, the overarching thing is that I feel that herbs can bring an empowerment to people in terms of taking care of simple, common, self-limiting complaints that are affecting themselves or their families, the people they love. And it's really something that has been lost over the last 50 to 100 years. We didn't always used to go to the pharmacy or to a physician for simple, common complaints. People used to kind of understand what their bodies were about and what illness was about. And so that's kind of one big overarching thing is reconnecting to the way we function in both health and disease so that we need to rely on primary care maybe a little bit less. The second thing that herbs can do for us is provide what we would call daily tonification. This is really preventive medicine. And some of the big issues in modern Western culture from a medical perspective involve chronic disease like cancer, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. And I am a firm believer that the concerted application of herbs or wild botanical biodiversity can help introduce phytochemicals into the human being that can go a long way in preventing some of those big three of Western disease.
Does any research support that's being done now onto how that kind of preventive medicine works? I mean, we know a lot about exercise and diet in terms of preventing certainly things like obesity, but also heart disease and in some cases things like cancer. But so what about the idea that these wild plants that you think should be in the diet are also contributing to that health?
Yeah, the research is proceeding on a couple of different fronts. We have pharmacologic research that kind of looks at small-scale contained models for understanding how these plants work. And we have clinical research that actually is starting to use these plants in relatively small populations of human beings to kind of see what kind of impact they have. And in terms of cancer prevention, we have some very good pharmacologic models that describe how medicinal mushrooms, for instance, or herbs like astragalus can help make sure that the immune system is on the lookout for cells that might be becoming malignant before they actually blossom into a full-blown cancer. We have a lot of research that looks at bioflavonoids from berries like our Vermont blueberries or hawthorn berries and how important they are at reducing the background level of inflammation in the heart and blood vessels to help prevent atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. And we're also starting to see that particularly bitter tasting plants, and I was just looking at a study this week on the use of artichoke, for instance, and how it can help regulate appetite and help control the overeating that sometimes is part of Western life and that many think is at the root of obesity. So between using good body movement and exercise and intelligent nutritional choices, herbs can kind of give you a little bit more background prevention to help have a healthy relationship with food, reduce inflammation in the system, and particularly the cardiovascular system, and potentially get the immune system to be a little more vigilant for things like cancer.
Okay, but before everybody jumps in the car and runs off to their pharmacy or their co-op to go buy all of those herbal supplements that you see in the medicinal aisles, you're not saying that people should just start popping more herbal pills necessarily.
Yeah, I think that that can be an important concern. Herbs are really living beings that grow in our gardens and in the fields. I'm not really a fan of exotic far-flung remedies. I mean, I think historically there's always been this idea that if it's very expensive and comes from far away and has a fancy name, then it must be better for me. And to be perfectly honest, I don't buy that. I think that a lot of the wild plants that grow around Vermont are fantastic for Vermonters. So that's usually where I recommend going. Now that said, there are some really unique plants from around the world that have very specific applications, but we tend to reserve those more for bigger problems or more acute situations. For example, the use of kava-kava, which is a Polynesian plant that is very helpful for anxiety for some folks. Not something you can really grow in Vermont. It's not frost hardy. Going further, if you can grow it, if you can find someone who can grow it, if you can get as close to the living plant as possible, I think that's where the power of herbal medicine comes out most dramatically. The stuff that you find at the drugstore, particularly in capsule form, is a little less relatable. You can't really taste it. It's harder to know exactly where that original growing plant material was. And so I try to stay as whole plant as I possibly can when using herbal medicine.
We're talking today about herbal medicine, herbal remedies, herbal sort of being a little bit more expansive than just specifically herbs in this case. We're talking with Guido Mazzei. He's the author of The Wild Medicine Solution, and he says herbs and other natural remedies are an important part of a balanced, healthy lifestyle. So what does that mean? Can you count blueberries as medicine? And should you go buy that bottle of echinacea pills from the pharmacy? If you have questions about this or questions about specific remedies that you've heard about and want to get some sense from Guido of whether or not it's effective, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So Guido, is it less effective to have an herbal remedy in a pill form than it would be to have it as the whole plant?
Well, not necessarily. A good amount of research is looking at one example is turmeric root, which is, again, not a Vermont native plant. It's a Southeast Asian and tropical rhizome, close cousin of ginger, responsible for the color in curry.
Yeah, beautiful orange color when that root is ground.
Especially if you get it fresh. You know, it's got this amazing orange color. And historically, it's just been cooked and eaten as a food, and it has good anti-inflammatory properties, and it can help with chronic musculoskeletal pain, things like arthritis, for instance. And the clinical research is looking at both turmeric as a whole ground powder, but also as an isolate of constituents of turmeric called curcuminoids that are separated from the rhizome and concentrated. And a lot of the research looks at that, and you can find a lot of these curcuminoid-rich capsules online and in stores. And I do use them and recommend them sometimes in my practice. And they are effective for the musculoskeletal pain and for reducing the chance that tumors will develop resistance to chemotherapy and those types of things. But what's interesting is that now whole turmeric preparations, especially when mixed with a little black pepper, are starting to get researched as well. And you're starting to see that they're almost as effective as this highly concentrated curcuminoid extract because you absorb more of it when you consume it as part of a whole plant matrix. So you actually get more curcuminoids in your bloodstream from whole turmeric root than by trying to isolate the chemical and concentrate it. So a lot of the stuff that you find in the stores can be just as effective as whole plants. I get a little wary when things get separated from the whole plant matrix because that's a strategy that we've been pursuing in medicine since morphine was isolated at the beginning of the 18th century. And it hasn't necessarily gotten us to a better understanding of how those plants work. It's really a cocktail of chemicals that a plant represents, and all these very interesting synergies are starting to get uncovered when you consume a plant as a whole. So I get a little wary of going the chemical isolate direction, and I try to stick again to more whole plant preparations.
We got a note from Patrick who wants to know about St. John's wort for anxiety and if that's effective.
Well, the clinical research looks particularly at St. John's wort for mild to moderate and sometimes severe depression. And the extracts that are used aren't necessarily concentrated. They're just marker compounds are measured to make sure that it actually is potent, pure St. John's wort. And that research has been pretty good historically. We have meta-analyses of St. John's wort now for mild to moderate and in some cases severe depression that point to its effectiveness. Now, anxiety can sometimes be a part of an overall picture of mental health. And St. John's wort has always historically been what's considered a warming and nutritive nervous system tonic. So my short answer would be if you have someone that you can talk to about using St. John's wort as part of your life, it might be useful for anxiety and to support mental health overall. But I really would speak to someone like an herbalist or a qualified medical doctor who knows about herbs before kind of starting self-medication with St. John's wort, especially if you're taking any other pharmaceuticals, which can definitely interact and their metabolism can interact with St. John's wort.
Guido, you mentioned speak to an herbalist or speak to a doctor who's well-versed in herbal remedies. It can be hard to find somebody who you trust or who you believe in this field because there's no real certification, right? No sort of nationally recognized standard. And certainly, you know, if you're looking at, and we can get more into this a little bit, but if you're looking at herbal supplements that you buy at a drugstore, they're not FDA approved. There's no approval from the Food and Drug Administration saying, yes, this is safe to take, or even, yes, this is what it purports to be.
Yes, and so that's a couple of questions. And first of all, I agree there isn't a national or even regional certification system for herbalists. The closest thing we have is the American Herbalists Guild, which is this fairly loose association of practitioners who peer review the experience of their herbalists before granting them professional certification. But I've met and worked with some amazing herbalists who are not professional members of the guild, and they're fantastic. This, to me, speaks to one of the potential benefits of integrating herbal medicine into the healthcare system a little more. It kind of forces you to get to know the person that you're working with, where a central certification system might provide a stamp of approval. It doesn't necessarily give the person the entire detail of what that person's practice would look like and whether they would be a good match. Whereas if you're trying to work with an herbalist, you got to go find them. You got to go talk to them. And herbalists come from a range of very diverse perspectives, which is one of the reasons why they're difficult to certify as a whole. There's no standard curriculum for becoming an herbalist. Have you studied in the Chinese tradition and the Ayurvedic tradition or in the Western herbal tradition? So think about what kind of things you would like in terms of a practitioner that would support your health. What type of systems do you resonate with? And then go out and try to find someone who dovetails well with that. This, I think, is really useful because it makes it important for you to develop a personal relationship with the person you're working with, which isn't always the case with what we would call modern technological medicine. And if we can get that idea that, you know, it behooves the patient to really do the research and get to know their practitioner, then I think that could do good, important changes for the medical system as a whole. And that's one thing that herbal medicine can offer, this sort of personal responsibility requirement for getting to know your practitioners. Now, in terms of supplements that you find on the shelf, the FDA has not approved Hawthorn Berry for cardiovascular disease. There are a few, like oats gets to make an FDA-approved claim that the consistent consumption of a certain amount of oats can help reduce cholesterol. In Canada, for instance, Health Canada, their alternative to the FDA, has approved a list of claims around herbal medicine that can be put on packaging, but the FDA has not.
Which ones are, what did they say in Canada and some of that, what are some examples?
Oh, there's a range. For instance, a plant like Devil's Claw can say for osteoarthritis, on the label because there's a decent body of evidence that supports its use for that purpose. The FDA in this country allows what are called structure function claims. It says supports a healthy musculoskeletal system, which is how we would describe an herb that might be helpful for a process like arthritis. The FDA, however, does have processes in place that describe how herbal supplement companies need to guarantee and ensure the identity, potency, and purity of what is put on the shelves. And that's where their regulatory authority really comes to bear in this country. So can they go and test absolutely everything? No, they rely on the industry to do that. And they will inspect and attempt to corroborate the claims for identity and potency that people put on the herbal supplements that are sold. They can't do it for everyone all the time, but I feel like they are really trying to enforce those requirements on the industry, and I totally get where they're coming from in that regard.
So the recent stories that have come out about some supplements being tested that purported to say they were, you know, garlic pills, but then when they were tested, no garlic was found, but in fact, garlic was found in other things that weren't considered or weren't labeled garlic pills. What's your take on that? Because it's been controversial, and for some people, sort of feels like a loss of trust in what they were trusting that these companies were telling them.
Yeah, you know, and it just brings home to me again the idea that the closer you can get to the supply chain, the closer you can get to that growing living being that is a medicinal plant, the better in terms of your ability to trust the quality of what you're getting. But this was a series of DNA tests that were conducted under the aegis of Attorney Schneiderman in New York. And they didn't find the DNA of the plants that were labeled on the pills, and in some cases found different DNA. But one of the arguments is that if you have a really good strainer, let's say, and you go and you check what's in your ginger tea that you might have made for your cold, you may not be able to find any DNA in that cup of tea because DNA is a cellular constituent. And if you strain that through a very fine mesh strainer, you may not actually have any cellular material in your cup of tea. You'll have zingiberine and shogols and other compounds that are found in ginger that are water soluble, but you may not actually find any DNA. So I believe that that was at least the response that GNC had to Attorney Schneiderman's accusation that they were selling products that did not have the herbs that they purported to have in them. And so they came back and provided chemical analysis of those same products, which said that, well, it contains the chemistry of the plants that they purport to have in them. And that is what the United States Pharmacopoeia has listed as an acceptable test for identity. Therefore, we stand behind our products. Now, this still doesn't answer for me why garlic was found in an herbal capsule that wasn't supposedly garlic. Maybe a little bit of contamination was occurring during manufacture. And again, you know, the bigger the company and the further down the supply chain you are, the more those types of issues can come into play, which is why I understand why FDA is really concerned about enforcing the identity of the herbal material that is sold on shelves.
We're talking today with herbalist Guido Mazet, and we're looking at what kinds of herbal remedies are effective, what you can grow here in Vermont, how you can add it to your diet. And we've got a lot of questions from our listeners, so when we come back, we're going to take a lot of calls, a lot of your emails. If you have a question, you can post it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. We're also going to find out a little bit more about what herbs grow really well in Vermont and how you can do that. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Guido Mazet is an herbalist with the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism in Montpelier and with Urban Moonshine, which sells liquid herbal extracts. He's with us today helping answer your questions about the value of herbal remedies and how they can be incorporated into a healthy lifestyle. And if you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Ashley's calling in from Queechee. Hi, Ashley. Go ahead.
Hi. So I've been working with plants as medicine and preventative medicine for about a year since my daughter was born. And I'm coming to believe or understand that it's really easy to compromise the nutritional and medicinal values of the plant and how you prepare it or how you ingest it. So for example, my daughter has a fever right now and she's got a cold coming on and I've been brewing her tea, but is it more effective to use a tincture to ingest for things like that, for illness?
Guido?
Yeah, thanks, Ashley. I hope your daughter gets a little better. I would suggest, especially for someone who's young, the tea preparation as being traditional and super safe. I don't like using alcohol-based tinctures in kids if I don't have to, absolutely. But your question speaks to the idea of a few different things in terms of extracting and also preserving herbs. Basically, whole herbs, especially if they're light constituents like leaves and flowers, we try not to store them for more than a year. Oxidation and UV damage can set in and they can become less potent fairly quickly. If they're powders, even less than that, you know, 6 months because of the greater surface area. Roots and barks can keep a little longer, whole berries, and the closer to whole a plant is, the longer it will keep in storage. And then usually the water extract, you know, making an infusion or a tea or simmering the roots or barks, if you're talking about a decoction, is a fine and very traditional way to go, especially for people at home. The tincture or the alcohol-based extract can extract certain constituents, especially the ones that are less water-soluble, like we were talking about turmeric earlier. The curcuminoids in turmeric don't come out in water incredibly well, but if you add a little fat, like coconut milk, to your curry, they extract a lot better.
Plus, it tastes so good.
It absolutely tastes good. And there's this traditional Ayurvedic preparation called golden milk, too, that involves whole milk and turmeric that is really great. But you can move to alcohol for those types of more fat-soluble, less water-soluble constituents. The other really nice thing about tinctures is that they really preserve the herb for a long period of time. My favorite story is around a black cohosh tincture that was pulled out of a basement in, I believe it's in New Hampshire, and they ran it through chemical analysis, and it was equally potent to the black cohosh tincture that was made the year before, even though it was 100 years old. So alcohol is a great preservative for herbs, and it extracts the oil-soluble constituents a little better. But by and large, using water is fantastic. And if you do have a plant that is more oily or resinous, adding some coconut milk or dairy milk to improve its solubility will work well also.
Thanks for the call, Ashley. Let's go to Angel Rain in St. Johnsbury. Go right ahead, Angel Rain. You're on the air.
Hi, Guido. I've been using and growing and wildcrafting herbs for about 40 years. But listening to you, I have so many questions. I'll try to keep it down to a couple. I'm curious about wild ginger root, the Canadian snake root that grows here in Vermont, and what the constituents are as opposed to the Jamaican ginger. And also, in terms of turmeric, what about the herbs that grow here, like yellow dot, gold thread, gold seal? Do they have the same constituents as the turmeric?
Thanks, Angel Rain. So the wild ginger that grows here is actually not a relative of the tropical ginger, and it contains a lot of the pungent compounds, and it's great to use once in a while as just sort of a pinch or an enlivening spice in a formula, but it's not something that I would recommend taking consistently. It's not something I would ever recommend taking during pregnancy. It's a member of the botanical family of the Araceae, and it may contain a little bit of what's called aristolochic acid, which has been linked to issues with the urinary tract and potentially bladder cancer. This is, you know, if you take it daily for years and years and years. So while it's okay to use as a spice here and there and an enlivener in formulas, I wouldn't recommend it as a substitute for the tropical ginger, and certainly not in pregnancy. It does have a little bit of a different chemistry. And then in terms of turmeric, it is a pretty unique substance. It's one of those plants that, you know, I'm grateful that we have a global economy sometimes because it's pretty unique. The activity on the musculoskeletal system for things like sports injuries or arthritis can be replicated through other plants that are a little more local, like birch bark or willow bark that have anti-inflammatory activity, but wintergreen even to a certain extent. But those plants are very cooling in energy compared to the sort of warm action of turmeric. Some of the yellow plants that you mentioned, like yellow dock or gold thread or golden seal, can replicate some of turmeric's action on the liver. It's also a very good anti-inflammatory for the liver and stimulates the release of a little bit of bile. But you can't get it in a whole package the way you can with turmeric root. And the one of my major uses for that rhizome for turmeric is the ability to slow down the rate at which cancer cells can develop resistance to chemotherapy. And that seems like a pretty unique activity of these pungent compounds, the curcuminoids. And so I haven't found anything in Vermont, unfortunately, that replicates that. So I usually recommend a lot of whole turmeric root for folks who are working with oncologists to deal with cancer.
Let's get one more call in here. Chris is on the line with us from Middlebury. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Guido. I realize after listening to you that this is on herbs, so I may have called too soon. I'm wondering if you can talk about chaga.
Yep. Thanks, Chris. So chaga is polypore fungus. It's a fungus that grows particularly on golden birch trees. And it kind of looks like someone took a blowtorch to a burl on the tree. It's like charred and black looking on the outside. But it's actually got a very interesting life cycle. After the tree dies and falls to the ground, the chaga will put out a fruiting body and will release spores to attempt to replicate. And the fruiting body looks totally different. But one of those big burls of chaga can take, you know, 30 or 40 years to develop. So I'm generally respectful of harvesting it and try not to over-harvest it if possible, if I find it in the Vermont woods while I'm hiking around. But it is one of our best mushrooms to use for cancer. It has melanin in it, which is immunomodulating and enhances the immune system's activity. It takes the betulin that's present in the birch tree and does its chemical magic on it, making it more bioavailable. Betulin is an ingredient that also has been researched in terms of supporting the human body in its fight against cancer. And it really does act as an excellent supportive remedy for people who are undergoing cancer treatment in conventional oncology to help keep their immune system strong and increase the vigilance of natural killer cells against cancer. You can take it, and it's rock hard if you have it. I use a 3-pound sledgehammer. I put it in a pillowcase and go at it with the 3-pound sledgehammer until it's kind of chunky, and then you can sort of powder it or at least grind it up in a coffee grinder. Then you simmer that. Simmer it from anywhere between 8 to 24 hours in a crock pot. It makes this beautiful black melanin-rich decoction. And you can freeze that in ice cube trays. Take a couple of ice cubes a day for support.
I'm enjoying the picture of you going at this burl with a 3-pound sledgehammer. I like that image.
Yeah, it can't be cut.
We're talking with Guido Mazet. He's an herbalist with the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism in Montpelier, and we're learning more about how you can add herbs to your diet to keep your health and vibrancy. You know, that example is something you can find naturally out in the woods. There are also herbs that you can cultivate in your own home garden, and we're joined now by Jeff Carpenter of the Zach Woods Herb Farm in Hyde Park. Hi, Jeff. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So give us a couple of examples of some of the herbs that you grow and you recommend to others.
Well, we grow over 50 species of herbs, so there are a lot that we grow. But herbs that I recommend others grow in their home gardens are, you know, generally herbs that are not only easy to grow but relatively familiar to people, things that, for example, people may use in their tea. Chamomile, for example, is familiar to most people, you know, as a nice beverage blend that's also effective at helping people reduce stress and anxiety and maybe even helping them sleep at night. You know, peppermint, lemon balm, or others that are easy to grow and tasty in a beverage tea and real familiar to people as well.
I understand that you also talk a little bit sometimes about things like stinging nettles and burdock and even dandelion. I've got a lot of dandelion, but I've never thought about cultivating it.
Yeah, it's great. When people come and to our farm and visit, and they see that we're growing in rows a lot of the herbs, a lot of the weeds that they're, you know, attempting to eradicate from their homes and gardens. These herbs in particular are very nutritive, very marketable, and, you know, accessible to people to grow on their own land or to even walk out in their lands and on the edges of their meadows and in woodlands and wild harvest, of course, with respect, as Guido mentioned earlier.
Jeff, you are, you know, helping give people some ideas of what they could grow in their own gardens, but this is your business. You do this actually commercially. So how do you make it work in Vermont?
That's correct. You know, we do have a relatively short growing season here in Vermont, but there are so many herbs in commerce that are suitable for growing in this climate. And we do, you know, pad a little bit on either end with season extension using greenhouses and row covers similar to the way vegetable growers are extending the season for those crops. But there are a number of herbs that we can grow successfully here, and we're having great success. The demand for our products has far exceeded the amount that we can produce. And we're encouraging others to join us in our efforts. Medicinal herbs can be a great aspect of increasing diversity on any farm.
We are talking to Jeff Carpenter of Zach Woods Herb Farm in Hyde Park. He and his wife, Melanie, run the farm. Jeff, thank you so much for telling us a little bit more about what you do and how other Vermonters can grow some stuff for themselves. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we're talking still with Guido Mazzei. We've got a lot of listeners who really want to chime in. So I'm going to get out of the way. I'm going to let them talk to you, Guido. Howard's calling in from Glen Sutton, Quebec. Hi, Howard. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. A very interesting program. I'm curious about elderberry syrup, which elderberries are grown quite easily here, and what you know about it and what you recommend its use for.
So elderberries are Elderberries are a time-honored remedy, and some of the modern clinical research looks at its ability to shorten the duration and intensity of influenza, typically taking the populations that are studied, the humans, down from 7 to about 3 or 4 days for a typical course of flu. And you take, of the syrup you talk about, you take a couple of tablespoons, maybe 3 or 4 times a day, and it's usually prepared by juicing the fresh purple black berry and preserving it with an equal part volume of honey, local raw honey ideally, and then storing it in the fridge over the winter. It makes a very, very easy syrup that's great for the flu.
All right, Lyle's with us from Belvedere. Hi, Lyle.
Hi there.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to know if the gentleman could talk about the acacia berry out of South America that's supposed to be very good for health. I just noticed they make a blueberry herbal tea that has the acacia berry extract in it. And I was wondering if you have any information on that.
Lyle, thanks for the call.
So, Lyle, the acai berry is it's one of these flavonoid-rich, anti-inflammatory, immune-enhancing berries that is very similar to our local Vermont blueberries and hawthorn berries. So my usual recommendation is if you want to try it, it's great, but you get a lot of the vitamin C support and a lot of the bioflavonoids. You just might need to take a little more of our local Vermont blueberries and hawthorn berries, but you get very similar results.
So just bottom line, Guido, I mean, you think people can find most of the things that can keep them healthy, can work to aid their immune system, aid in keeping their health up right here in Vermont? I mean, even during these winter months where nothing grows?
I don't know about finding it during winter, but if you get a little bit savvy about preparing and preserving, you can find all of it during the growing season. And especially if you get to know folks like Jeff who grow some amazing medicinal plants in good quantities and with really high quality, then definitely. There are a few other herbs that you might need to bring to bear, like turmeric. But for general prevention and health and vibrancy for yourself and those you love, Vermont is a blessed and amazing place for medicinal plants.
That's Guido Mazzei. He's co-director and co-founder of the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism in Montpelier, and he's the chief herbalist at Urban Moonshine, which sells liquid herbal extracts. We have links to both at vpr.net. His book is called The Wild Medicine Solution. Thank you so much for coming on the show again.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, if you drove by the Shelburne Museum earlier this winter, you might have seen gaggles of school kids sledding down the sprawling museum's hills. They were winter campers, and they were a visible sign of the changes the nationally known museum is going through. We'll hear more next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Shelburne Museum has been around for almost 70 years. Often considered a Vermont treasure, its sprawling campus is home to one of the most important collections of American folk art and artifacts in the country. But the museum's leaders are taking it in a new direction, and that's caused some uneasiness among some Shelburne Museum fans, some joy among others. 7 Days reporter Catherine Flagg just wrote about the evolution of the Shelburne Museum in the paper, and she joins us now to talk a little bit about where the museum wants to be heading. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
So what's so special, first of all, about the Shelburne Museum's collection of American folk art?
Well, a lot of Vermonters might take this for granted, but it is really a world-renowned collection of folk art. Over 150,000 artifacts in its collection, including everything from quilts to hooked rugs to 2,000 antique trivets, and then some really eclectic things as well. There's some beautiful Impressionist paintings, furniture, really almost anything you could imagine, decoys. And so this is a really unusual facility. 39 roofs, I think, different buildings on the campus, unlike anything else really in the country.
And a lot of that collection and that eclectic nature of it that you mentioned really goes back to the founder, Electra Havemeyer Webb, who was this heiress who was really kind of a collector.
Absolutely. So Electra, Mrs. Webb, as she's still called by most museum employees, grew up in a family that really valued collecting art, but her parents focused on fine European and Asian art. Electra, however, took this liking to folk art at a time before folk art was even really established or widely recognized. In fact, there's this great story about her mother coming up to her home in Shelburne and saying, "Oh my gosh, Electra, how could you live with all this American trash when you grew up with Rembrandts and Manets?" But Electra really wasn't deterred. She collected in earnest, and we're not talking about a chest of drawers here and a painting there. She just acquired this enormous collection of artifacts and objects. And then in 1947, as she and her husband had retired and relocated permanently to Vermont, they decided to set up this museum. And then in that period between 47 and 1960, when she died, they brought a bunch of buildings to the campus, just really threw themselves into creating this unique place.
So people who've gone in recent years will notice that this is an eclectic museum and that there are these very sort of strange collections in the permanent collection there, and they may have walked through, you know, some of the circus art or
yes.
gone for a ride on the little merry-go-round. But other patrons will notice that there have also been some kind of different exhibits in recent years. One that comes to mind was the museum's own Andrew Wyeth painting was the centerpiece of a Wyeth exhibit that showcased the three Wyeth painters, or two photographic exhibits that are a little bit different for the museum, the most recent one being Nathan Benn's National
yes.
Geographic photographs, especially of Vermont in the 1970s, mm-hmm. but also a really fabulous exhibition of Ansel Adams photographs paired with Edward Bertinsky's really industrial landscapes a couple of years ago, which was kind of mind-blowing, but kind of seemed like a different direction for the museum.
Yes. So the critics will say, oh, Electra would be rolling in her grave. What is this? This isn't a museum for fine arts or contemporary arts. But what the museum's leaders and what its fans say is that Electra had this sort of wide-ranging taste, and what she wanted in 1947 or 1960 might not be exactly what we get today, but we can use that eclectic taste as a launch pad for looking at all kinds of different art. And the museum has really been going through this transition in recent years as it thinks about how to incorporate fine art and contemporary art in the collection. It's trying to take that historic collection and make it relevant to the modern visitor. Part of this transition, which is a very visible part of it, is just the shift to year-round operation. There was a sense that Shelburne was literally a hidden treasure for more than 6 months of the year because the doors were closed.
And there was a big fence up if you were driving along Route 7 in Shelburne.
So the big fence has come down. There's still a fence, so you can't go wandering in the middle of the night through the museum grounds. But it's a much more welcoming place. The idea is to really open it up to the community. There's a new sidewalk, so you can walk up from the Shelburne Village. And there's a beautiful new building, the Pizzagalli Center, which opened about a year and a half ago.
Although that characterization, beautiful new building, even that is contested by some who think the building is not
yes.
particularly attractive.
Well, yes. So beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I'm sure. The idea, though, is that it is a state-of-the-art facility that is able to host the kind of exhibits that previously the Shelburne couldn't acquire. So traveling exhibits that are put together by other museums or art that really needs to be in very perfectly climate-controlled facilities. The Pizzagalli is now a place for that to come. And so Vermonters now we have more than just sort of the historic collection. We have this access to traveling exhibits that previously you might have had to go to Brooklyn or other major cities to see.
And the museum is trying to attract more Vermonters in. I mean, I mentioned a little while ago that there were kids out sledding in the museum hills because they had a winter camp for kids, and they have educational sessions for adults now because it's open all year round.
Yeah, so this is part of the effort to really reconnect with the Vermont audience. The Shelburne Museum is considered a major tourist destination, and especially during the summer, the numbers of visitors that come through are huge, close to 100,000 people last year between May and October. In the winter, you're not seeing quite that same audience. It's much more the local residents, the school kids, the families that are looking for something to do on a snowy Saturday morning. And so the museum has been going through some growing pains as it figures out what is going to bring people in the door? How do we make sure that that local audience is excited about what's going on here and just knows that this is a new resource now in the middle of the winter?
So besides the idea that Electra might have hated this, what do naysayers say is wrong with this new approach by the museum?
You know, there's a sense that, you know, I think the naysayers are those who hate any kind of change. And the fans say that change is inevitable and that this is really an opportunity. You know, they also point out that Electra, at the end of her life, was starting to show some changing tastes as well. There's this great story about her beginning to acquire modern American painters. She bought George O'Keeffe, and, you know, paintings by Walt Kuhn and Charles Sheeler, and, of course, the Andrew Wyeth. And then when she died in 1960, her children sent most of those back to the galleries because they thought, well, what does modern painting have to do with Americana? And so maybe Electra would have been very, very pleased with what is going on in the museum today.
Well, it sounds like you heard that story, that she would be very pleased. By yes, a lot of museum leaders in
absolutely,
your research.
Absolutely. They're excited to go back and sort of think about that option.
That's Catherine Flagg. She's a reporter for 7 days, and she's been telling us about changes at the Shelburne Museum, home to one of the country's best collections of American folk art. We have a link to Catherine's article on the museum's evolution at vpr.net. What a pleasure to have you on the program again.
Thank you so much.
And it's time now for letters. Joining me to read from your messages is Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangari. Hey, Rick.
Hi, Jane. So on Monday, we spoke with Susan Clark and Frank Bryan. They're the authors of All Those in Favor. And we talked about whether or not town meeting is still relevant and what could be done to improve involvement by Vermonters. That prompted Gary in Richmond to write, "Town meeting day is outdated. It is difficult for people to take off work and participate. The fact is, most people can stop by to vote, but they can't stay and discuss issues. If you want more citizen participation, I think the answer is to make it easier for people to vote on local and statewide issues. I have lived in other states that have statewide referendums, and I am very much in favor of having them in Vermont."
By the way, if you want to see what Vermonters did decide on town meeting day, we have a lot of coverage at vpr.net. You'll be able to find all of it, including what a lot of towns voted on municipal budgets and school budgets and other things. And on that subject, Chris in South Burlington says, "Overturning the Brigham decision or abolishing Act 60 and Act 68 might improve attendance by putting school funding back in control of local communities. In larger communities like South Burlington that have grown so dramatically in the last 20 or so years, we've also seen the loss of that personal touch and weekly face-to-face contact with council representatives, whether it be at the post office, grocery store, or elsewhere."
On Tuesday, when we rebroadcast our program that poked at the myth of Vermont exceptionalism, we heard from Enough of This, who commented, "Vermont ceased being an exceptional place to live on the day people outnumbered dairy cows."
And Julia in North Chittenden added, "As a local amateur historian, writer, and walking tour guide, I can see the persistent evidence of the independence and community expressed in our state motto, freedom and unity. We were never a colony, but first a frontier caught up in the struggles for control of territory, then a republic with our own constitution until acceptance into the Union in 1791. The leaders who led the actions and forged the first documents that established Vermont as an entity under law were remarkable individuals by any standard. I like to believe that those values have been passed down in families through the generations, more or less intact."
That is exceptional. Yesterday, we spoke with Johnson State psychology professor Gina Miro about how humor develops in infants and what it says about babies' understanding of the world around them. We received this question from Kevin. "Do we know yet whether the lack of such humor cues in young babies is a good indicator of later in life conditions such as autism or social anxiety?"
Well, we put that question to Dr. Miro, and here is her answer.
"For an infant who is not laughing, we don't have data to be able to link that up with something later in life. That's kind of the long and short of it. I think that if a lack of laughter exists in a bigger context where the infant is not making eye contact, they're not engaged, then I might raise that with a pediatrician and just follow up and find out, you know, any concerns that a parent has. That's probably a really good starting point.
If you missed that show and the fabulous sound of the laughing baby we played at the beginning, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. There you'll find all our shows archived and available to listen to and to share.
And we love hearing from you on anything that we've broadcast. We are on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition, or you can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Oh, yeah, Jane.
And that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, as we reach the halfway point of the current legislative session, we'll hear from a panel of the state's top political reporters on what's been accomplished so far and what to expect before the end of the session. We'll discuss the budget gap, education reform, and Lake Champlain cleanup, among other issues. Send your questions or comments, again, to vermontedition@vpr.net, and then listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Our show is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Steve Zinn, with production assistance from Melody Baudette. Peter Biello directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.